You're listening to On Margins. I'm Craig Mod, and this is episode 8. I want to begin today just by thanking you all for being here and tuning in. On Margins is supported by the membership of people like you to the Explorers Club on craigmod.com. If you enjoy this monthly podcast and want to send a very strong signal to me that you want more of it, please consider joining the Explorers Club. It goes a long way. More at craigmod.com/membership. Today, I'm speaking with the designer, letterer, and now author, Jessica Hish. You have almost certainly seen Jessica's work. She refreshed logos for MailChimp, Southern Living, Eventbrite. She did the logo for the incredible California Sunday magazine. She did titles for Wes Anderson's Moonlight Kingdom. She designed covers for books like Dave Eggers' The Circle and Hologram for The King, and for Elizabeth Gilbert's Committed, among many, 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 many more books. She teaches, she writes, she gives workshops. She is a very busy human being. And amidst all this chaos of production and client work and public speaking and baby making, she wrote and designed and lettered a beautiful children's book that came out in 2018. Today we talk about how that book came to be, her creative processes, and how to cold email someone you admire and maybe even get a response. Here we go. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning, Craig.
Or good afternoon, or wherever, whatever it may be over there at this moment.
Afternoon right now, it's 3 o'clock.
And you are in the studio.
I am in the studio. My beautiful, well-lit, nice but loud but on the outside studio right now.
And this is in San Francisco or Oakland?
In San Francisco. My studio will eventually be in Oakland, but that is about a year away.
And is this a studio you've had for like a decade now?
Yeah, it's been 7 years, a long time.
Holy moly. And this is the studio after Studio Mates in Brooklyn.
Well, sort of. The Studio Mates in Brooklyn I was in for about a year. And then after that, I was back in my beloved pencil factory in Greenpoint.
Oh, right. Okay.
And then I moved to San Francisco from the pencil factory and then hung on to that studio for way too long, like an extra 3 years.
as we do. But I remember the first time we met was at a Studio Mates holiday party, I think.
Yes, most likely. I feel like I've met the entire internet during that Studio Mates time. I've looked back at photos and I have met founders of companies in San Francisco that I thought I met in San Francisco, but I actually met them in Brooklyn a long time ago.
Yeah. I feel like Swiss Miss is like, you know, is the Dalai Lama of connectors. She's like the UN.
She is the most super connector of all the super connectors.
It's pretty bonkers. But yeah, I think we met there a trillion years ago. I think this was before you were a New York Times bestselling author.
So. Oh, well, that's a very recent turn of affairs. So thanks for like the immediate plug, though, on the podcast. Now everyone will listen.
Right. You weren't important. Now you are. You know, that was a time when you were a little more humble, I have to say.
Well, I don't know about that. Like, I think that it was probably my least humble time because I was like 24 and thought that everything that I made was awesome. Right. But in like a very like, you know, not trying to say it's more awesome than you. It's just awesome in its own right way.
Right. So. Yeah. But now you're like, now I've been vetted by the world and I've been put up on the list. So
I sold some books for 1 week. It was
indisputable.
Great.
Was it just for 1 week on the list or?
So far, you know, who knows? The holidays are upon us. Also, I haven't had any major celebrities come out and say they like me yet. So fingers crossed, Michelle Obama gets a copy of that book.
She is a listener. She's actually the only listener. I only did this podcast for Michelle Obama.
I would hand deliver this podcast to her if I found out, like some, however that means, like on a Sony Walkman, I would bring it to her.
On a mini disc.
If I knew that she would listen to it.
So we met like a trillion years ago at Studio Mates randomly, and then we stayed in touch and we've had lots of coffees and dinners and things like that. And I remember like, I don't know, 6 years ago, maybe 7 years ago in San Francisco, I think we were having dinner at a Japanese vegan restaurant on Valencia, possibly.
Likely. I love that place and I am a huge soup fan and I take people to soup if they allow me to.
High likelihood that we were eating soup that night. And you were like, hey, you know publishing stuff, Mr. Publishing Person. I I have a book that I'm working on. And I think you showed me, I may be hallucinating this. I may have just like dreamed this, but I'm pretty sure you showed me spreads from Tomorrow I'll Be Brave like 6 years ago at that dinner.
I don't think it would have been that long ago because that is before I had children. And I definitely started this book when I had a child, but very soon after having her. And she's like north of 3.5 now. Okay. And I started when she was like 9 months old. But we have had many dinners, so it could have been a dinner after this fact. I did show it to you when it was very, very early stage, though. I do remember that.
Yeah, maybe that was a Gigome or something. I just remember seeing the twinklings of the genesis of this thing. That was like, what should I do? You know, where's it going to go? How's it going to, you know?
Yeah, I think I saw you right after. For every project that I ever do, I have this like insane, like creative flame out of just like me working for 4 or 5 days without stopping and then generating like a third of the project and then just not working on it after that and needing to get as many people to tell me it's great as possible. So you saw me like right after that first crazy push where I was like, I think I'm going to do this. But yeah. I needed a bunch of people to tell me that it was worth doing. Probably. Well,
I mean, the very standard, you know, sort of thing. You're like, I have this intuition about this thing that I want to make, and you kind of touch it, and then you're like, ugh, I'm so afraid of it now. Let me step back until I get permission to go and kind of make it real. Let's walk through, because I think it's really interesting that you ended up at Penguin Random House with this book. If you don't mind, let's talk through a little bit of that process.
Sure, sure. So yeah, I can walk you through the super early stuff. So I had released a book about my work called In Progress, and I went through Chronicle for that. But it wasn't like this bee in my bonnet, like I have to make this thing. They had approached me about making a book about my work. And then I was kind of hesitant about putting it together at all because I felt like I didn't want to put together a monograph of my stuff because I was so young and it felt like presumptuous and all those things. But then ultimately I ended up being really happy and like proud of where it ended up. But through seeing my process through that and seeing how a bunch of other friends have dealt with publishing, I was kind of dead set on self-publishing after that, like whatever project I would do after that, just sort of knowing that like publishers lean on you really hard to promote the books and, you know, publishing is definitely not like a get rich quick scheme of an industry. And so I really thought like, oh my God, I love this new concept for this book and I'm really hot on it and I feel like it could be a really big thing, but I wanted to just do it all myself and figure out a way to put it into the world myself because I know it's just my people that are going to want it anyway. So I was working on it. And right when I had shown you, I had done like a few of the initial spreads and was still like really excited about it, but was having a hard time moving forward because I cannot work on anything without deadlines or people getting mad at me. And what ended up happening was I tried to keep myself accountable by actually showing it at a number of conferences as like a, hey, check out this secret project I'm working on. But that didn't quite work well enough to keep me on it. You know, when you start getting other client work coming in and have other stuff that's like tugging at your calendar. So I got approached when I showed it at ICON, which is the illustration conference they have every other year in different locations, by an art director from Penguin who was like, hey, if you actually ever do want to work with a publisher, like I'd love to look at this. So let me know. And, you know, I kind of backburnered it and it was, over a year before I reached out to any publishers. But I was pregnant with my son. And so this would have been, man, a good year after I started it. And I hadn't done any like major updates to the project in that year. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm about to stare down the barrel of another baby and I need to get someone to push this out of me before it's too late. And so I totally lied to a ton of publishers in New York and told them that I was going to be in New York for some unforeseen other reason. And I just used it as an excuse to set up meetings. And I have a lot of contacts at different publishers just because I've done so much book cover work. So I just reached out to the art departments of every publisher that I've ever worked with to be like, hey, I'm going to be passing through town. I'm working on this kid's book. Here's the manuscript. Here's like 3 finalized spreads. Here's some sketch ideas for the rest of it. Would you be able to put me in touch with your children's department? I would love to be able to show this in person and sort of talk about it. And I just got such a great reception from people. And I set up 4 meetings on my own before I even started working with a literary agent to set up additional meetings.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I basically went from like zero to 60 in terms of meeting with publishers and had like 7 or 8 meetings lined up in a 3-day period to meet with different publishers about it.
Nice. Well, that's the way to do it. I mean, but like you said, you've spent your whole career kind of building up these contacts. It's amazing that you were able to sort of turn those into real meetings. And
that's the thing is I've been really conservative, you know, using a lot of those contacts
right.
because I have a very low tolerance for like icky social stuff.
Yeah.
And so I tend to be way more conservative than I need to about utilizing contacts and putting people in touch with people and that kind of thing, just because it rubs me the wrong way when I feel like someone's using me for someone that I know,
totally.
Or, you know, it's like a little too transparent about how transactional their thing is. So in general, like I have lots of abilities to make connections about projects and chips to cash in and stuff, but I haven't really done it that much. And it wasn't until this project that I actually started doing it because it felt important enough. Like it didn't feel like I was doing it for anyone other than myself and that the project itself was worthwhile to like actually push myself to do those things that are a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you're doing something for a client, you're not like, oh, let me reach out to every important person that I know and like suck the life out of them for this client project that's not actually self-authored by me, you know?
Right. People respect the conservative or like just not even conservative, but just like the delicate, the thoughtful use of contacts. You know, I mean, I get some pretty weird pings and I've definitely bent over a little bit in weird ways to like introduce people to someone or someone else. And then they don't follow up on the intro. You know,
yeah.
That's sort of the worst thing you could do.
Oh man, I hate like the will you intro me to so much. It chills me to the bone. And it's such a San Francisco thing. It's like not really a thing in New York. I don't know if it's just like nobody intros people to people in New York. You just like ask for someone's contact information and then you blindly contact them and say, I got your email from blah, 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 you know?
My trick when I was like 27 or whatever, and I was like, I don't know anyone in New York, was I had made a book. I had done Art Space Tokyo and I was like, all right, I'm just going to mail this to all the people I want to meet. And so I mailed it to like, you know, Koi Vin and like, you know, what any designer I could think of that I was like, I totally want to meet this person. And guess what? That's like a pretty good way to set up meetings if you mail people a beautiful thing and go, hey, I made this. And like, I'd love to just talk with you. So yeah, I definitely bristle a little bit sometimes at the intro request, but you know, sometimes they can be really good. And if the person wanting the intro is incredible, like that's always nice to connect two great people.
Oh yeah. I mean, well, that's a whole other thing, you know, like connecting two great people is a no-brainer. It's like the stranger contacting you being like, hey, I know that you know this person and I'm having a charity drive for my thing, but you don't know me. And lol, and I'm just like, ugh.
No.
You know, and then I have to send the preemptive one to them being like, hey man, I don't know this person, but I'm trying to be nice and they're doing a charity thing. I don't know. Use your best judgment at the end.
You know? Which is horrible because it's already a red flag and you're basically offloading the pain of rejecting this other person to the person they're trying to connect with.
I know. And then I feel bad about that because then I'm like, you know, I was literally just complaining today about how like my one email inbox has like 400 emails in it. And the oldest one is from December 5th. And I'm just like, oh God, I don't want to ever contribute to that for someone else. You know?
Wait, December 5th from this year or last year?
From this year.
Oh my God. You're good. You're on top of stuff.
No,
I'm like, I've got emails from like 2015. I still feel like I need to respond.
Oh, no. I have in my work inbox, I have unanswered emails from 2015 that are just like somebody that's a very kind person asking me to do them a favor. And I just can't delete it because I'm like, maybe I'll want to do this sometime.
Right. In like 15 years, I'm definitely going to want to do this thing that I didn't want to do for the last 5. But just to kind of finish off this thought on like how to do good intros, because I think there is a way to do it. I've definitely gotten cold requests from people that I immediately say yes to. And the difference between those, and these are people that I've never heard of, that I don't know, I have no connection to, we don't have any overlapping friends. But the difference there is that the email I get feels so emotionally mature and self-aware and not super long. You know, sometimes you get these crazy, you know, 3 or 4 or 5,000 word emails. That's not good.
Yeah, my life story.
It's just, you know, right to the point, maybe maximum 300 to 500 words that signals that this person is got their shit together and that whatever you do, like to help them or to connect with them or be on their podcast or whatever, you immediately feel that it's not going to be a burden.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly what the magic sauce is.
I think part of the magic sauce is that that person needs to have it be a very low pressure. Yeah. I realize this is a big ask, I want to do a thing. And it'd be cool if you wanted to do it. Like the big thing is you have to give someone the ability to say no really easily, because actually if you give that to them, they probably won't do it.
Right.
You know, if you don't give it to them, then they will do it right away. Cause they're like, this is too much pressure. I don't want to do it. I don't know.
Right. And if you give them the option to say no and they say no, they'll remember you as the kind person who gave them the option. And maybe next time, you know, it won't be a no.
Yeah. There's almost every conference I spoke at last year were people that asked me 3 years in a row. I was like, okay, fine. You know?
Yeah. Well, dude, I spoke at Smashing Conf today and Vitaly, we looked up the emails and literally he had sent me 6 years of every single year.
Yeah. Well, he's notoriously relentless. Like he's like a cartoonishly relentless organizer of conferences. I love it though. He's very sweet.
But we were just laughing. I was like, next time, let's make it less than 6 years of emails. But sometimes it takes that long. And, you know, and part of the reason why I didn't write Vitaly off is because he was always so genuine. It was like, okay, this guy is not full of BS and yada, yada, yada. But anyway, so you had built up a great network of connections because you're respectful about these connections that you have. And in the end, you ended up going with Penguin Random House. Were you waffling at all?
I was waffling a little bit. I had a few good offers. So I was thinking about Abrams because I have some really good personal connections to Abrams and I really love their book program for kids.
Yep.
I think that they, you know, they focus on making like really age appropriate stuff that teaches like important lessons and that kind of thing. And they always hire like spectacular illustrators for all their stuff. So it's just like their program's a lot smaller, but it's really tight. So I was like really hot on potentially working with them. And then I got another competitive offer from Simon & Schuster. And theirs was kind of like a, what do you want from us kind of thing where they left it like really open because they were like, hey, you just presented this all in like a silver platter. What do you actually want out of a publishing relationship? And made me feel like, you know, I would have kind of a big say in it. And I definitely got like a, like what I would describe in my meeting with them is I could feel like the dollar signs in their eyes, which I couldn't feel at some of the other meetings where like they were talking to me being like, this is a big deal, which made me feel like super confident and like hot shit. And so I was like still very much thinking about working with them too. And then with Penguin, you know, it was sort of a different thing where they were one of the first people to reach out to me about the book. I've had a really great relationship with Penguin in general, just from working with them over the years. And of course, like, you know, their reputation's super stellar. But they were starting this new imprint that was brand new. And their whole thing was like, hey, this is one of the first books that we'll be publishing under this imprint. And we want to really like high pry it and, you know, give it a lot of attention. And we think that this is like a big deal. And I got a lot of like, hey, this is a big deal project. We really want to prioritize you from both them and Simon & Schuster. And so it just kind of came down to like, who do I want to get in like a shotgun marriage with based on emotional connection, you know, kind of. And it was Penguin. Like I just really felt like everybody on the team I was really vibing with and that it just seemed like that's just how I am in general with work where I would much rather have like a better personal connection with a client then have it be work out like super crazy financially or something like that. Like, you know, ideal if it's both, but you know, for me, I knew it was going to be a long haul process and I just wanted to make sure that it felt like lovey dovey and awesome. Cause what I really told them and what I tell them throughout the whole process is, you know, I have a lot of energy to put out into a project and into promoting a project, but I only put out as much as I get back from whoever I'm partnering with. And if I'm not getting the energy back, I'm not going to tap all my resources and I'm not going to call in all my favors and do all that kind of stuff because it's not worth it for me if I feel like the project itself isn't at that level for them.
Yep. And you felt from the Penguin folks, like they were just like, yes, you were.
Yeah, they were like, absolutely, we are in. Like, you know, like, let's do it. Let's go to Mars together. You know, it was just like, and it was very immediate and they were very good at sort of like along the whole way, anytime that I was like, I don't know about this. They're like, oh my God, what do you need? You know, and it was like, they were, you know, on top of it. And it's a very rare, weird experience with a publisher, because most authors don't get the experience that I have had with Penguin. Because what ended up happening is, because I got that love from them up front, that they were like, yes, this is a priority for us. We want to make sure this is awesome and as good as it can be and gets as many places as possible, that I actually did the work and like promoted it a lot during its pre-sale, which meant that the sales numbers were high enough that they were salivating and got all the salespeople in the rest of Penguin right on board, which made them elevate it to like a lead title, which then got a lot more resources on board. And then I was like having meetings with 13 people talking about PR strategies and all that kind of stuff, which is not a thing that authors get to do with publishers ever.
Right. I think you've had a pretty unique experience. So we're like,
it was very, I was just back there. They have like an annual sales conference and that's like internal. And it happened to coincide with my dates for coming back to New York to do some of my book events. And they had me come in for like a 30-person champagne toast in the morning before their sales conference. And I was like, what is this world? Well, it's just like, I like can't even tell this story to other people that have published books, because the usual thing is like, they'll write one blog post about you and then everything else is on you.
right. And then when you try to email them, hey guys, is everything cool over there? Like silence.
Yeah. Like, you're like, how many books have we sold? And they're like, oh, let me just get back to you in 6 days with just an email with a number in it and no actual report.
12. Sorry, I've noticed that my key doesn't work here anymore. I feel like that's more like what happens with most arrangements. But so you're in this PR meeting with 13 people, and are they just like, Jessica, we've got this idea. Jessica, we've got this idea. Hey,
well, first I went in and I was like, let me tell you all the things that I'm doing. Right. And so like, I just laid out all this stuff because I was going totally ham, you know, like I was just so pumped that I was like, I'm working on these t-shirts and I'm making sterling silver jewelry for it. And then I'm talking to Alaska Airlines about partnering for the book tour. And then I'm going to reach out to, you know, and all this stuff. And they're like, what, you know? And then they like had a presentation to show me, but like, you should have seen some of their faces. They were just like, yes, please. You just do this all, please.
Their presentation was like, so we're going to make a Twitter account for you. And we were thinking about, have you heard of this Instagram?
Like, we're thinking about doing a pre-sale contest. I got you guys. Don't worry.
Yeah, you were definitely, I would say, an ideal author, you know?
Oh, yeah. And definitely. I mean, because of it, they... Literally anytime I like feel wigged out about something, like whatever it is, they're like, oh my God, we're so sorry. Let's fix it right away. You know?
Right.
Cause they're just like, please don't stop your crazy machine that is helping to sell this book.
every time you send like an email that's like mildly unhappy, someone's fired. What do you mean, Jessica? A little bit unhappy. You're out of here.
It does feel, I mean, I'm not a person that likes to butt heads in projects. Like, that's not my MO.
Right.
But it does feel really good to feel like if I very strongly disagree about something, I can win, you know? So that has been nice.
Well, and that's how it should be. I mean, you've built up a tremendous amount of support and power and fans and stuff over the years. And like, this book means a lot to you and you have a strong creative vision. I mean, it's like, you should have all the power in the situation. It makes me wonder, like, did you think about kickstarting this thing?
I did. I definitely did. But I didn't think that this was going to be my Kickstarter. For one thing, my schedule is so wackadoo just because of having two kids and traveling and all this kind of stuff, that the idea of like having even the tiniest anything to do with order fulfillment was just a nightmare to me. Like, no. And also, like, I am of the belief that every creative person that has an audience gets one successful Kickstarter in their life. Yeah, and then other than that, it's just like par at best, you know?
Yep.
And I didn't think that this book needed to be that, you know, like when I have some crazy idea for a project and I need people to just believe in me, I'll go to Kickstarter for that.
Right.
Or if it's like an insane production thing and nobody wants to do it because they don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Right.
That's one thing. But, you know, people want to make books. It's fine. I think part of it too is like one of the reasons I wanted to work with a major publisher is because I felt like I really wanted the audience of this book to go past my design world, you know? Because I knew that the designers would buy it and I am grateful for them for it. And I know that they're like my core people. And I'm seeing that, especially while being on tour, you know, basically like if I do a book event and don't tell the designers about it, there's like two people there. Right, and if I tell the designers, there's like 400.
Right.
So I don't want to disregard that audience at all, but I wanted to, because I felt like the book had a message that was much wider than design. It's not a book about lettering. It's a totally different thing.
Right.
I wanted it to be in front of as many eyes as possible. And, you know, doing it myself through Kickstarter wouldn't have enabled that.
Totally. And like, you know, Penguin is the kind of company that can put you on, you know, Barnes and Noble tables all across the Midwest, which is hard to do with Kickstarter, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you just can't get store presence stuff with Kickstarter. And even I know that, you know, a lot of publications don't want to review self-published books as much as they want to review things that are published by publishing houses. Like, I don't know if the New York Times has changed their view on this, but I don't think they review things that are self-published.
Right. So. I don't know the specifics on that either, but probably not. It's kind of like the Academy not, you know, giving Academy Awards to things that haven't been in movie theaters.
Yeah. And it's a similar thing with even the New York Times list. You know, with the New York Times list, if I bought, like, say I sold, you know, 20,000 copies through Kickstarter, that wouldn't count towards a bestseller at all because bulk sales don't count. It's only small purchases through independent bookstores or booksellers, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting, the pluses and minuses. I mean, the thing with Kickstarter is you probably would have just made more money, or maybe you wouldn't have made more money. I don't know what...
No, I definitely would have made more money. But the thing about it is, it's like, to me, I see this as a slow burn. Like, I am all about the slow burn passive income and trying to get as many of those streams as possible so that, like, I have a long game of just eventually down the line, I will be making $100,000 a year in passive income.
Yeah.
That's my goal. I don't think it's going to happen in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, but that's my ultimate goal. Right. I want to, like, get to that point where I don't have to have a retirement account because I just have passive income that is my income.
Right, right. Well, what are your other passive income streams right now?
Skillshare has been great.
Oh, right,
I have Skillshare classes. Right. I have another one that's coming out in January that I have not even announced yet. It's totally new. And it's all about doing book cover designs.
Oh, fantastic.
But it actually, like, it's about book covers, but it's about everything, you know, because book covers are sort of an encapsulation for most design projects, like one-off design projects.
Yep.
And that's been, like, you know, because of the quality of the videos that I've been able to produce with them, because they come to me and produce them for me and do all the editing, which means that it's really not a big deal for me to make them. It's like basically a 4 or 5 day commitment.
Right.
And the quality is way higher than if I would have recorded on my own.
Right.
It ends up being an awesome return, even with their membership model. When they first started out and it was just like people paying for tickets, it was bonkers. Like my first year of doing Kickstarter, when all of the you know, artists on it got 85% of the ticket price,
it was
totally crazy.
That's the trick, is to get aligned with like these new services right when they start up. You know, they're still in like super generous mode. They're like, we'll give you everything you want.
Yeah, you need to get in when they're in super generous mode. And I've seen a lot of, you know, I know a lot of folks have walked away from things like this that have a membership model just because they're like, oh my God, if I do this on my own, then I make all the money. And it's so similar to Kickstarter, where you're like, if your audience is there and you want to do all the work and you want to invest in it, then yes, like, go for it. You will make more money if you do it that way.
Yep.
But it's just way more work and you have to really want to do it.
And like you said, the audience is also limited, you know?
Yeah,
and
the audience is limited.
I think that's, you know, one of the big reasons why to push through any of these sort of gatekeepers, you know, whether it's like you're publishing articles for magazines or you're doing books, you can do stuff independently on your website. Of course, that's always an option. And if you've built up an audience, that's great. But even still, you know, if you publish something through Penguin Random House, like, that is totally going to be in a bunch of kids' bedrooms that you would have never been able to reach otherwise. And I guess, like, in the end, the question is the philosophical question of, what is the purpose of producing this object? Like, why am I making this thing? Why am I putting it out in the world?
Yeah. And the answer is often like, well, eventually I want to justify making it monetarily in some way. But like, your lead answer is never like, because I want to make a ton of money on it. Because like, that's not the line of work to get into if you're into fast cash, you know?
Totally easier ways to do that.
There's like, way easier so ways easier. To make money than to spend a year and a half on a project and know that it's going to take you 2 years to get your small advance back. You know, like,
Even startup people, like I've had young startup people come to me and they're like, hey man, yeah, I'm just going to like do this startup and, you know, sell it for like, I don't know, a couple million dollars in a couple of years. I'm like, first of all, probably not the easiest. Yeah. I'm like, if you really feel that thing needs to be done and has to be in the world, like go for it. But if you're just looking to make a couple million dollars, like go work at Goldman. That's a pretty easy way to make a couple million dollars, like guaranteed. Don't publish a book and don't work for an early stage startup.
One of my girlfriends is a cartoonist and she's publishing a book as well. And she told me that like she gets people that are like super successful, like in other fields that she knows, contacting her to be like, how did you do it? I've been trying to publish a book for years. And she's like, why are you doing that? Yeah. Like, keep doing your incredibly successful thing that you're doing.
It's like you really need to feel more than anything else that thing has to be in the world. That's the only
reason. And you have to like, I mean, the main thing is too, not only do you have to feel like it has to be in the world, but you have to believe in it so much that you want it to like be your identity for years.
Yes.
Because like people are just going to, it's the only thing you're going to be asked questions about. And if you don't really believe in it, like if you start a business not knowing that, the business is going to go nowhere. Yeah. Because unless you can passionately talk about it, not only in like one or two interviews, but for years, it's going to go nowhere.
Yep.
And so you really have to feel it.
And I think that is totally underestimated. You know, the connection of identity to the books you put out and really for how many years that lasts.
It's difficult to understand until you've had a piece that you've made take over your identity, which not everybody experiences. You know, like some, there's tons of creatives in the world that have never had that happen to them and might never have that happen to them. But once you have it happen to you, you understand the gravity of a self-authored project becoming successful, you know, where you're just like, I really have to believe in this because otherwise I'm going to hate every interview that I ever do and every press request I ever get.
Totally. Yeah. I completely feel that. So one of the things that I don't know if you meant to do this or not, but your book, Tomorrow I'll Be Brave, is actually, it's a pretty good language learning book. I've been reading it with some young kids here in Japan, and you know they're not native English speakers, but they have some English background. And it's been really, really interesting because a lot of the words are pretty long. They're big words. And the way you've written them, like the lettering kind of makes it so it's not immediately obvious like exactly what all the letters are sometimes. I mean, there's just like the playfulness of it. If you're not a native speaker, you kind of have to like parse it out slowly. And it's been really fun to kind of like, I start reading to the kids and these are like kids who are like 6 or 7 or 8 or 9. And then I'll be like, okay, what do you think this one is? You know, and tomorrow I'll be curious, you know, and they're like, curious, you know, and like, curious. What do you think that means? And it's actually a really awesome language book. I don't know if you even thought about
that. That's super cool.
Yeah. It was very surprising. I was like, oh, actually, this is very neat. And these are words that they've definitely not run into before.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny because the book itself, I ran into some roadblocks just, you know, with people giving me a hard time about it being like crazy lettering because kids are, you know, a lot of kids are just learning to read and it might be too crazy for them. But my defense to that has always been like, this is not a young reader's book. Right. This is a picture book, which is a totally different thing. But I have gotten some feedback from parents being like, I don't know what you were intending to do with this book, but it's ticking every box with my kid. And like my kid's like learning how to read with your big words. Yeah. I was like, that's crazy. I do think that seeing language really big on a page just gets kids amped.
Yeah.
For sure. But I didn't anticipate that it could be used in that way. You know, like it's one of those like nice to haves, but did not seek it. So that's really cool to hear though, that they have been digging it in that way.
Yeah. Well, and I think the lettering turns into a puzzle.
Yeah. I think that that's definitely true because I think that as kids are learning to read, they get really frustrated because parents just start hammering these like phonetic sounds into you and it's all just becomes work really fast.
Yeah.
So anything to keep it like a puzzle is probably really good.
Yeah. I totally felt that. And in fact, I have a question from a young reader over here, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Her name is Mizuki. She's 9 years old. And her question is, how does a bunny father make a kitty child?
This is a great question. So when I initially conceived of the characters being a bunny and a cat, and that the bunny does have a parent in the book, I didn't want the role of the cat to be extremely specific, right? Mm-hmm. I wanted it so that maybe it's a sibling, maybe it's a friend, maybe it's a pet, but it depends on how you perceive it at your house based on what your house looks like, right? So if you have a sibling, a younger sibling, then you're going to see your younger sibling in that cat. And if you have a best friend and not a younger sibling yet, maybe you'll see them in the cat. So yeah, I wanted it to be a little ambiguous. I figured if it was a little bunny, it'd be like instant tidy sibling.
It completely adds a sub-story to the book. It makes it way more mature suddenly.
Yeah. And then also, I mean, if it is a sibling, you can have a whole conversation about adoption. You know, like there's all this stuff that can kind of be brought up about mixed families and this kind of thing.
Totally.
I purposefully only showed one parent in this book also because I wanted it to be like any home situation. And it's not necessarily to me like the bunny is the dad because I put glasses on him like my husband, but like there's nothing saying that's not a mom bunny that's wearing glasses and just has, you know, loungewear like the rest of us have.
Right. Well, yeah. So when we got to that page, immediately she picked up and she said, the father's a bunny. How does that work? And I was like, well, you know, the fertility of bunnies is vastly overrated. they aren't that fertile, actually. And this family just, they wanted two kids. And so, you know, there are lots of kitty cats. You see all the posters for kitty cats who need homes. And so this bunny family decided to adopt this kitty cat.
Perfect.
She was like, oh, that makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely, that's okay.
You're like, yes.
I can dig that now. Is the book going to come out in Japanese?
Yeah. I mean, I would truly love to have it come out in so many different languages. Yeah. I just have to, yes, I have to read you all the lettering. And then I'd also want to work with someone to help keep it just as musical and rhymy in that language as it is in English, because it would be a real shame if it just became really like flat when it got translated. So.
And did that come up with Penguin? Were they like, man, you know, it'd be awesome if maybe instead of using this crazy lettering, you just wrote it in like Times New Roman? Could we just do that to make the translations real easy?
You know, it didn't. But I do think that that's one of the reasons why I had initially intended to self-publish it is because there was a lot of stuff that I saw as being red flags for publishers where I was just like, I don't want to have this conversation because I don't want anybody to tell me that it's not possible to do this. Because I've worked on books before where they make you make all the text black so that it can be swapped out easily on its own plate and like that kind of thing. And I just didn't, I was like, I know that this is going to be an issue where this book just like can't be internationalized very easily. There's art that runs across the spread for like every single page. You know, there's all this stuff that a lot of conservative publishers would be really weird, like wigged out about. And they were like, no, don't worry about it. We know that. That's just part of this project. It's fine.
Yeah. But I mean, like that constraint is also where all the power comes from. Having these like giant words that you kind of have to decipher and stuff like that's where the heart of the book lives. How many spreads did you do that didn't make it into the book?
I had another word originally. I was going to do one about silly. That didn't make it in. And part of that was just like for length. Once I figured out it had to be 40 pages and all that kind of stuff, just trying to cut it down. We had to do some cutting with how the end came together just because I had to cut a full spread. I had like another like goodnight spread in it or something like that just to get the pacing right and to make it hit the page count. But the way that I work is that I'm very like iterative on top of the same illustration. So I start with like a sketch and then keep reworking that until I feel okay. And then I add color to that. And then, you know, kind of keep going and adding detail and adding detail. And so most of the spreads came together over time fairly naturally. And there were only a couple of them that gave me like a really hard time, like the adventurous spread. Yep. I just did so many iterations of that one because I just like couldn't get the hierarchy right. And it just felt like everything was the same size across the spreads. And I knew I wanted it to be this like really like pink, bright sunset, but I didn't know how to get the contrast of the letters plus the ship like working together so that you could still read the word, but it wasn't like dominating the page. So that one required a bunch of finagling and redrawing. It being the first spread of the book also didn't help because I felt like the pressure was on to make it really awesome. But everything else felt like it came together a little bit more naturally.
I love the running spread, like with all the animals kind of like sprinting.
Oh yeah. That one, I did so many loose sketches for the animals first. I had all these like gibberish pencil sketches of me just like trying to get the energy right and figure out the scale of the animals. And then when I actually was working on the final, like the main thing was just making sure that it felt like this huge wave of big animals coming in from the left side.
Totally. Well, and what's so, I think, striking about it is like, you know, you have obviously all these pages with big words on them. The action's a little bit smaller. And then you turn to that spread and it's like, whoo, it hits you in the face. Like, whoa, who are all these animals? And man, they all look so happy. Those are the happiest running animals I've ever seen in my life.
I think it's the elephant that's like the elephant sweating a little though. I think he looks a little winded, but
yeah. But they're all like, you know, they're all good people. They all have good hearts. Like those.
Oh yeah, yeah. They all look like they're having fun. It's competitive, but in a fun way.
Right,
you know.
right. So there are two or three spreads that didn't make it in that you had done or thought about into the final product.
I was trying to make a few spreads more quiet. And I made this one spread that I loved that was just like all pink. And it was like a silhouette of the dad bunny, like hugging the bunny while the bunny had like a little tear. And then the cat was like being playful and trying to cheer up the bunny. And I just really loved this like silhouetted image. And it was such a tender moment. And I was like, oh man, this makes me want to redo like the whole book to have more minimalism and all this stuff. And then they were like, we have to cut that one for length anyway. And I was like, okay.
It's like, this is why I went with the big guys. Cause they're gonna help me not have this thing spiral out for another 3 years.
But I have that one in my back pocket. Like I don't think I ever made that into like final art. Like I did a really tight sketch for that one.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm gonna like do a final piece of that at some point, just cause I really like it.
When you say tight sketch, do you mean like a digital file that's sort of there, but not?
I sketch by hand a bit, usually when I'm just trying to like come up with my ideas and get a general sense of the layout. I'll just do like really crappy pencil sketches. So I actually, what I would do is print out spreads from the book with the typesetting in there, just on like laser paper, and then do like loose sketches on top of them of what I thought would kind of be on the page so that I could pace it out. And then once I was actually like, you know, doing my proper sketches, I have been sketching more frequently on an iPad in Procreate.
Okay.
Especially for this project because color became such a big deal.
And the iPad just does color better than desktop or?
Well, I mean, I never sketch on desktop. Sketching is always an activity that I would do like in coffee shops in a literal sketchbook. And okay. So the iPad has become my coffee shop device.
Interesting.
You know, Procreate is an amazing program because it's so simple. It's just for drawing, you know, and there are people that make like crazy paintings in it. And that's not me.
Right.
I use it in the same rudimentary way that I would just be making sketches by hand, which is to make like not perfect sketches using the most basic of brushes in there.
Right.
And because I use it in such a rudimentary way, it feels very natural to me. It feels like I'm sketching by hand, except I can undo, which is so nice.
Right.
And I don't have to break out all the art supplies at a table, like on an airplane, which is super weird.
Right. It sounds like you start with the type and then you build around that.
With this one, I did just, but that's actually mostly because I was so comfortable with the type and lettering, and the illustration was something that I felt really rusty on.
Okay.
When I was saying I start with the type, like I would literally like typeset the words in the font that I was using, just like the words, not the lettering.
Oh, okay.
And sketch on that page.
I see.
But when it came to actually working on the final art, I would often take the lettering pieces almost to like full final and then sketch all the illustration around them. But that's just because I felt more comfortable doing the lettering than I did the illustration, just because I've been doing only lettering for like 8 years.
I was looking on your website, on the Tomorrow Be Brave website, and I noticed they had some coming soon for posters and other things like that. Are you still working on those? Yeah.
So I have a bunch of things. I am touring like a madwoman right now, which means...
How many talks have you given?
Well, I'm going to 26 cities total.
Oh, wow.
And they're basically, my travel schedule is I'm gone every Wednesday to Friday and I go to two cities between Wednesday and Friday. And then I come home and I am, you know, working quote unquote on Monday and Tuesday. But a lot of times it's like doctor's appointments and random other life stuff that I have to do while I'm in town. And so it's just been hard to kind of get everything up on the site and like actually get the production of it going. But I have a lot of pokers in the fire of things that I've made or am making. So I made these like cast characters from the book as a sterling silver necklace.
Oh, wow.
I'm really pumped about those. Whoa. And they look so good. But I'm hand assembling them myself. So I'm like teaching myself how to solder to do it, which is really fun. And then I'm making stuffed animals of the bunny.
Oh, wow.
And those I should be done in March. I'm working with a company that does a lot of stuff for Comic-Con artists. I made t-shirts in kid sizes that I haven't put up yet, but I have in hand. I made a number of prints that I produced for West Coast Craft, which is a, you know, really awesome curated craft show here. And I do plan to sell those on the site, but I wanted to, you know, wait through the holiday season actually, because I didn't want them to go that fast because I don't have the ability to produce them as fast as they might have gone during that time. So I'm going to post them sometime in the new year. But yeah, there's like a whole mess of stuff. I basically just went totally crazy and spent way too much money making products for this stuff.
Amazing. And just so people who are listening who may have questions about like copyright ownership and things like that, this is all your stuff. Like Penguin doesn't have a hand in any of this.
Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, like publishers would, I mean, my contract basically says they have world US rights to the book. Yep. And that's as far as that goes.
Interesting.
Anything else with the characters and stuff, I own all that and can do whatever I want with it. And I think most publishers would keep it that way just because they're not going to have the budget to like do anything anyway, for the most part.
Right.
And so they're happy to let you kind of run with it and do your thing and take the responsibility out of their court.
And for that contract, I know you said you approached publishers on your own and then you got an agent afterwards. And so then were you going back and forth with the agent to negotiate all that?
Yeah, I ended up signing with a literary agent during the week of my meetings.
Okay.
So like by the time I was getting my contracts in, he was able to review those. So he was extremely happy that he basically got delivered a project on a platter and only had to do minimum work for it.
He was like, oh, wow, yeah, I should buy a lotto ticket today too. Amazing. In the end, what value did the agent bring to the table that you now see that you maybe couldn't have seen before?
Well, for me, I haven't dealt with a lot of international rights stuff yet, but I did actually already have him renegotiate a previous contract with Chronicle for my international rights stuff with them, just because I had a Spanish publisher buy the rights to my Chronicle book, and then they redid the cover without ever showing it to me. And I did not want that to happen at all in the future.
Wow, okay.
Because it's a book about hand lettering and it's not really cool when someone else hand letters your cover of your book in a way that is not following the guidance within the book itself. So I wanted to make sure that that was a thing. So that, I mean, that alone has been great. And then I just always find that having a second person in your court when there's a difficult conversation to have, or when you need some random thing to get done and you like, it's just businessing related, it's just really nice to have that person. And even like last week or 2 weeks ago, Penguin came to me with some changes on another project, and it like set off all my red flags and like sent me into an emotional spiral. And I was like, I need you to be my agent therapist for 5 phone calls in a row while I talk through my emotions so that I don't immediately get on a call with them and freak out, you know?
Oh, no. But it's resolved.
So I think like I've always been someone that needs, one, I need someone to bounce things off of that is like a circle of trust person that knows what they're doing, yep, but also is like can give me the straight shit.
Yep.
And I do like to have someone in my corner when I feel like being like businesswoman with a capital B,
yep,
but I don't want to like be a wrathful partner in the program, you know?
You need a bad cop on your side.
I need a bad cop because I'm not a good bad cop.
Right.
I'm a terrible bad cop. Everyone knows that I hate doing it. And they're like, why are you doing this? And I'm like, I know, I don't want to. Can't we just all, nobody gets paid ever. It's fine. You know, let's just be friends. I just want a hug. Pay me in hugs.
Yeah, you definitely need a bad cop then.
Yeah, totally.
Well, Jessica, you know, congrats on everything. This book is incredible. It is an amazing design object, but it's also, strangely, a really good English language learning tool, as I found over here in Japan. And thank you for taking time and helping illuminate the process you went through to make this thing real and put it out in the world.
Yeah, of course. Happy to. Happy to get other people to make things that are scary and require a giant emotional and personal investment.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
As I said in the beginning, This podcast is made possible by your membership. Consider joining the Explorers Club at craigmod.com/membership. Man, now I know what it feels like to run a public radio station. This episode is also sponsored by the entirety of the Japanese notebook industry. So specific, quirky, tactile, so many of them. Notebooks from Japan. What do they do? Dare I say it? Oh, I do. They spark joy. Oh, yes. That first joy spark Marie Kondo experienced was actually touching an MD notebook in Shinjuku Gyoen so many years back. Her husband, then just one of many suitors, a papermaker, brought it with him on their very first date. Under the cherry blossoms in early April, he took that wax paper-wrapped notebook out of his Porter Man satchel and said, "Kore wa dou dai? Ii desho?" And it was in that moment Marie Kondo knew the world needed to be as perfectly refined and minimalist as the small, blank tome she held in her hand. So thank you, paper people and notebook industry of Japan, for making this world so much more tidy than it ever deserved to be.